crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back in 2 weeks. On today's show, Professor Nolan Higdon discusses his recent Project Censored series, Justice for Sale. A look at private for-profit prisons, recidivism, poor treatment of prisoners, and more. Then, we'll have a speech from former Black Panther Charlotte O'Neal, a.k.a. Mama C., we'll play highlights from her talk, Empowering Students in Social Justice. Will you stay with us? Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's show, for the first segment, we are joined by Professor Nolan Higdon. He is a college history instructor and Project Censored affiliate professor in the San Francisco Bay Area. He sits on the board of directors for the Media Freedom Foundation, Project Censored, and ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education. We'll be talking about Nolan Higdon's series, Justice for Sale, in its 5 parts available at projectcensored.org. The first part of Justice for Sale is Declining Faith, Rising Police Violence. The second, From Acquiescence to Profit. The third part of Justice for Sale is Greed Breeds Corruption. Part 4 is Corruption and Abuse, the Remnants of Greed. And the 5th part of the Justice for Sale series is Rebellious Action in a Corrupt Time. Professor Nolan Higdon joins us today to talk about Justice for Sale. Nolan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on today, Mickey.
Absolutely. Nolan, let's talk about what was the impetus for this project, this 5-part series, Justice for Sale.
Well, I want to know more about sort of how this acquiescence toward police violence came about in the United States. I noticed consistently in media and in conversations that there was this almost automatic defense for police and the imprisonment of U.S. citizens at a time when the size of the prisons is growing. And so I was very interested in sort of knowing where that derived from, where we got to this point in the United States where there was this overall support for police violence in the prison state. And I really found that it has many origins, different forms throughout U.S. history. But most recently, I'd say in the 1970s, I saw a sort of change in the national discourse on prisons and police violence. And it had to do specifically with the war on drugs, which comes out of the 1970s. And basically, Nixon and the Republican Party and the Democrats thereafter realized that there was a lot of political capital in attacking drugs and presenting yourself as hard on crime, specifically drug crime. And this continued. There's still president after president, congressman to congressman, mayors, governors. This harsh on crime was good politics. And in order to present yourself as a politician who is tough on crime, you sort of had to put your money where your mouth is. And so the creation of the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA, and these other agencies cost big, big money. 1972, the DEA was created with a budget of $75 million. As most recent as 2013, its budget is currently $2.02 billion. So this politics of being tough on crime continued. I think Reagan really was sort of the president who really took it to the mainstream, a lot more, how should we say, expansive than Nixon. Reagan promoted mandatory minimum sentencing. He wanted to minimize the insanity defense. He tried to defeat anti-death penalty legislation. He cut access to bail, extended sentences, cut access to parole, basically just championed mass incarceration. And the national political discourse has continued since then, whether it be George H.W. Bush, who attacked his opponent for being liberal on crime, soft on crime. Bill Clinton added 100,000 new police officers.
Well, right, interject momentarily. You just mentioned George Herbert Walker Bush and the Dukakis election, Michael Dukakis in 1988. That was the infamous Willie Horton ad, right? The propaganda, the soft on crime propaganda.
which actually brings up another great point. If you look at this situation, you say, okay, these politicians are feeding this political capital. How is that being sold to people, though? Why are people wanting to spend a lot of money on police and seeing this? And a lot of it was racially motivated. Race politics was tied to this growing police state as well. And Willie Horton's a perfect example. Willie Horton, a convict who was let out on a program that Dukakis, as governor of Massachusetts, had allowed. And while he was out, he committed a rape. And his face was used as a piece in, I believe it was Time magazine, where they darkened his face and darkened around his eyes to give this more depth, darker, blacker color to a gentleman who was already African-American. And it was basically race baiting, that the liberals let out these sort of evil black figures was the message that was sent. And it made good politics. Again, this little wave to race enabled George H.W. Bush to win that election.
Now, there are several elements, of course, to your series. It's a fairly lengthy series, and we're going to go into some more detail here. But before we leave the Reagan years, let's get back to this mandatory minimum sentencing. What exactly did this do to the prison population? And again, this was tied pretty closely to the so-called war on drugs.
I said in the 1970s, the drug war was good politics. That continued in the 80s. And the mandatory minimum sentencing was another part of that. Basically, they tried to make drug schedules and put sentencing laws in place for those drugs. So everyone knows the sort of famous stat that the mandatory minimum sentencing when it came to crack and cocaine use was about a ratio of 100 to 1. It's since dropped down to 17 to 1 about 20 years later. This was demonstrative. Crack was believed to be more an African-American drug or used by people of color, and cocaine was believed to be used more like by whites. But nonetheless, collectively, mandatory minimum sentencing, you have people who are in jail for a lot longer. And basically what this is going to lead into is it's going to breed a platform. It creates a market for the prison industry. At the same time that these politicians are promoting this tough on crime, let's also remember the economic philosophy of these politicians. We end up in this neoliberal age, this promotion of privatizing, deregulating, basically putting things that had used to be public, like prisons, in the hands of private corporations. And with these mandatory minimum sentencing laws, there's going to be a whole new bunch of prisoners coming in who are going to be there longer than they would have been without these laws. So now you've created a market.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about that, the rise of the private prison system. You talk about that, I believe, in parts 2 and 3 of the series you have, Justice for Sale. So, Nolan Higdon, let's talk a little bit about this rise of private prisons. If you build it, they will come.
The private prison system, like I said, comes out of this drug war and this interest in creating good politics, but it kind of becomes a beast that can no longer be controlled. And that is to say that, you know, today, if you even look at the massive profits that the prison industry is collecting, it gives it a lot of power to lobby. I mean, they're going to start lobbying for different laws, like immigration was a big issue in the last couple of years. And the private prison industry were the ones who were most opposed to a legal path to immigration because it cut into their profits. The Corrections Corporation of America has a $5.1 billion contract to build and operate immigration detention centers. If you offer a legal path to immigration, that's a contract they're going to lose. So this beast is created out of this market I talked about. And in the 1980s, these corporations start expanding, like the CCA I mentioned, or the GEO Group is another one. And they take home billions of dollars of taxpayer money to run these prisons. And where we're at today is, you know, the United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. 1% of the U.S. population is incarcerated. It's a larger percent of any Western industrialized nation. Incarceration has been on the rise in 36 states since the 1980s. And if you actually add in the citizens who are on probation or parole, you have 2.9% of our adult population in correctional supervision. And mind you, that's not including the children. 70,000 children. Now, the United Nations has condemned the U.S. for locking up children for life, the amount of children we have, the amount of prisoners we have. The Supreme Court did rule in 2012 that the U.S. need to stop sending minors to jail for life. But we're waiting to see if, you know, there's going to be any actual enforcement of that ruling.
Yeah, these are all riveting details. And in your research of this, of course, this is something that we posted and published at Project Censored. What was your cursory impression of the way corporate media tends to cover these issues, if they actually cover them at all, or if they connect any of these dots?
The corporate media really does not connect the dots. We get, you know, attention or lip service even paid to events that happen in Ferguson, and Ferguson is talked about somewhat in depth more than other places. But, you know, there's Fergusons all across the country. I mean, that sort of dot was not connected. Not to mention how the prison industry also impacts areas like Ferguson. When you have people consistently getting arrested, this is time when they're not filling their resume. They're not garnering skills. Many of them cannot get hired. Michelle Alexander brilliantly showed that in her book, The New Jim Crow. And so when these individuals leave prison, return to these neighborhoods, they really have no sort of opportunity, economically speaking. So not only is this damaging for, I believe, society as a whole, but also the individual. The individual has sort of nowhere to go. There is no rehabilitation in place. And you see also that the very people who are suffering the worst from the prison system and the police state are the ones who are paying the taxes to keep it going. I think that's sort of like the most shocking thing. And I didn't hear much discussion of that inside the corporate media.
You know, you write about the high cost of the private prison industry in your piece From Acquiescence to Profit here, part two of the Justice for Sale series. And this is where you're mentioning CCA and GEO and their multi-billion dollar assets and so forth. You mentioned one of the high costs here, or hidden costs, of course, is the bloated prison population. But you also mention a few other details about the contracts that are between governments and these prisons. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'd have to say one of the most fascinating things I read while researching this was the contracts. These contracts are passed with states, and in the contracts, the state agrees to keep the beds somewhere between 70 to 100% full. And I'm not exaggerating. You can read the actual contracts for yourself. They're public records, 70 to 100% full. Basically, if the state doesn't put enough warm bodies in the bed, it gets penalized under the contract. And so even when these corporations are found abusing the contract, i.e. not staffing with enough people to make the place safe, not feeding the prisoners, etc., or even falsifying hours like we saw in places like Idaho, if the state wants to cut the contract, it's going to cost them millions of dollars to cut it early because they have a contract that guarantees these beds will be filled for a certain amount of time. California and Arizona have some of the largest percentages in their contracts. And this sets a really bad precedent. And speaking of the corporate media, which we touched upon a moment ago, this would be something definitely for the corporate media to cover. This is something people would care about. This is money out of their pocket, keeping people locked up. But this is sort of the key, like, bait and switch that the corporate media does here, because who are the people that tend to be in jail that are talked about in the corporate media? It tends to be people of color, sometimes who are pedophiles. There are these people in society that don't have a strong lobbying group at the national politic, and thus there's not a bunch of outrage. There's this consistent voter turnout to support these harsher and harsher laws on these individuals, even though it's coming at the expense of those people who support them.
Well, things like three strikes laws, for example, in California. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, then. The lobbying for prison profits, the private prison industry lobbying public officials for favorable contracts. And so, for example, you talk in the piece here about the CCA. You talk about the amount of money they spend on lobbying versus the amount of money that they're getting, you know, getting back, right? And then also maybe let's tie that into how that is affecting overcrowding in prisons.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said before, they sort of create this beast that they can't control, that is the political class does and the voters. Because once these prisons are in place and they start getting more and more citizens locked up, these prison industries have more capital to start lobbying. And they lobby for things like the life without parole laws. And in the 1970s, like, next to no states had life without parole laws. By 2014, 40 states had them. It's estimated that it costs about $1.7 billion more in money than if these LWOP laws didn't exist. So the lobbying, it changes the game, but it also brings in more prisoners. And you bring in more prisoners, states end up in a weird situation because you can't overcrowd your prisons under federal law. So then the states have to build more prisons. So where do they go to? They go back to the prison industry. So this means new contracts. And in the state like California we're sitting in right now, just a couple years ago, California had a $16 billion shortfall, and they still spent $8.8 billion on corrections. So this is embedded in the system that the taxpayers are supporting this.
We're speaking with Professor Nolan Higdon about his recent Project Censored series, Justice for Sale. We will continue this conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
I don't want to spend the rest of my life looking at the barrel of an armor lies. I don't want to spend the rest of my days keeping out of trouble like a soldier saying. I don't want to spend my time in hell looking at the walls of a prison cell.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today we're speaking with Professor Nolan Higdon about his Project Censored series, Justice for Sale. We've been talking about the five-part series, and we left off by talking about the sort of a neoliberal industry and neoliberal policies that are behind this prison industrial complex. We want to talk about some more elements to this. In particular, Nolan Higdon, in the third part of your series, Greed Breeds Corruption. Let's get into some of the details in that segment of your report.
This is something that often, surprisingly, little mentioned. But when there is a for-profit motive, it does tend to breed corruption. And I'm not just talking about prisons here. We're talking about Wall Street. We're talking about politics. We're talking about education. It happens in all these different parts of society. And so in my third piece, I sort of connected what happened in Wall Street in 2007, 2008 to what happened in the prison industry. And basically, when there's this for-profit model that increasingly starts getting added to the justice system in the late 1970s, we started to see massive corruption. What do I mean by that? We saw the Kids for Cash scandal, which took place in Pennsylvania, where there was $2.6 million in bribes that were paid from a corporation that had a youth facility there. And judges were locking people up in exchange for these bribes. 5,000 children were incarcerated for such crimes as stealing DVDs from Walmart or trespassing in vacant buildings. Luckily, this is one of the cases that got discovered and there was some sort of justice served, but who knows how many other places this is happening right now. Even the concept that a corporation would feel comfortable in paying bribes to lock individuals up is sort of demonstrative of the breeding ground that this for-profit justice system has bred. Other corruption, though, as well within the system is people falsifying hours. Workers falsify hours at a lot of these facilities. In Idaho, there was thousands of work hours that were falsified. And the reason was because Idaho had a rule about how many staff members had to be present. And the prison corporation wanted to save money, so they didn't have those people on site. But when they knew they were going to get busted, they falsified these people existed so the state would continue paying them. And what's worse is when the state, like Idaho, went to cancel the contract, they realized they had another 2 years on the contract.
These are a lot of amazing details. That is one thing I have to say about the series here is that it's very well sourced. And again, the figures don't lie. They do tell a story of corruption. You mentioned earlier the immigration centers, you know, and you had written that the prison industry spent $45 million lobbying in order to get a $5 billion contract. So again, lobbying, maybe we could call it legalized bribery or lawful corruption. But there's big returns on this, and there's a lot of money awash here in the system. And also it's the case that you illustrated earlier that because of the contracts between the state and private prison industry, the private prisons can profit even further at taxpayer expense if we don't continue to fill the jails. So we have to have more laws, put more people in prison, right? And that justifies this bloated police state, right? And we've seen, of course, since 9/11, the 1033 program, we've seen more and more militarization of the streets. And you also wrote about the increase of SWAT raids and all these kind of things. So there's a ramped up effort among the police state to round up more potential criminals for profit.
Oh, absolutely. The for-profit model is huge. That's what I mean by corruption. It totally changes the game. And we spoke earlier about media, right? And I talked about the voters consistently support this harsh on crime attitude. And this is a major problem. Crime has been going down since the 1970s. But people's perception of crime, two-thirds of people polled consistently say crime is going up, even though it's been dropping for decades. And that's demonstrative, I think, of the weakness of the corporate media here. It's one thing to be uninformed. Everybody's uninformed on something. They don't know about something else going on somewhere. But to be misinformed, that means someone has to place this idea in your head. Someone had to place the concept that crime is increasing in two-thirds of Americans' heads. And they support these budgets. And I mean, sadly, you know, we talk about the amount of money being spent on crime. Four states actually spend more on corrections than higher education. Vermont, Michigan, Oregon, and Connecticut. You know, that's a huge stat right there to explain how out of control this problem has gotten.
Again, when we look, too, at this bloated prison system, again, also the increase in police state, what we see here is it's really a systematic effort to generate more problems, it almost appears to be, than actually exist. And the problem with media, I'm very glad you brought that up, this is an ongoing affair. In fact, if you go back and look through the 90s and then 2000s up through to the present, we've seen a consistent pattern of statistical decrease in violent crime coupled with a vast increase in corporate news media coverage of violent crime, leaving the public with the potential impression that, again, crime is an extraordinary problem. It's a problem that can seemingly affect anyone anywhere, and this potentially leads the public to support so-called tough-on-crime political figures.
Absolutely. And this is why, you know, the prison industry can basically get away with creating contracts, as you said. I mean, in Kentucky, they put a bill on the floor to create a prison for the elderly. And Kentucky lawmakers were like, this didn't come from any of us. The CCA basically put it on the floor for a vote. And this is the amount of power they have, where they're now creating legislation, not even called for by the people. And it's being discussed and debated on the floors of state houses across the country. And also, for instance, another one, basically the goal of this is to continue having profits come in. These prisoners are only worth profit when they're locked up. And so in my fourth piece, I was able to go down to do a case study of Coalinga State Hospital.
Right, and you refer to that as the Coalinga prison as a mind-boggling boondoggle for California. That was your description.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect when I was there. And you have to understand that Coalinga Prison and Coalinga State Hospital are right next to each other, surrounded by hugely tall chain link fences and barbed wire. But one of them is a prison, and one of them is supposed to house people who are done with their sentencing. And basically, what happened was, in a lot of the uproar in the 1990s over pedophiles, California voters consistently put stricter laws on people who were found guilty of having sexual assault on youth. And a law that was passed was basically to say that the California voters didn't want these convicted pedophiles to continue getting out of jail if they were going to commit a crime again. So the prison industry lobbied to have psychiatrists review individuals after they serve their sentence to decide if they can get out of prison. The concept being that if they're going to commit a crime again, they're not allowed to leave the prison. Of course, the problem should be glaring to anyone. You can't tell what someone is going to do based on their circumstances. And this seemed to be distant from the voters. They're willing to spend this money on people who have already served their sentence. So what happens to the people who serve their sentence and aren't allowed out? They're supposed to be held in an area of least resistance, basically a free place inside walls for just other sex offenders.
And you say here civil detainees at the Coalinga State Hospital are not officially imprisoned.
Yes. I went physically, was on site, and stood in both these, the prison and the hospital, and I can't tell you the difference. The only difference I saw is that the staff got angry when I referred to the civil detainees as prisoners. That was the only difference I saw between the two facilities. But again, this is another boondoggle of huge amounts of money. Some of these psychiatrists are taking home millions of dollars over a decade's time. Some are taking home about $500,000 a year to decide whether or not someone is going to commit a sex crime again. And obviously, since there's no real perfect detection system, individuals are getting released who do go out and commit crimes again. And yet these psychiatrists are still collecting their paychecks. On the other hand, we don't know who's locked up that wouldn't have committed again, that we're paying this private corporation to keep locked up. And if that wasn't bad enough, the scandal goes even deeper. The individuals who are in there, since it's not a prison, they have to pay a daily fee for their food, for their housing, and all this to the state of California. Well, obviously, when you're in a state hospital, you're not making a lot of money. So they keep a sheet that adds up all the money you owe them. Well, when these individuals, you know, either pass away or can't pay their money, it's up to the taxpayers to fill that void to the corporation. So by having these individuals exist in these hospitals, they're collecting huge amounts of debt that the taxpayers are going to have to pay.
Yeah, more hidden costs we certainly see here. Also, it says that the state of California had to admit that the sexually violent predator detection program was, quote, ineffective and unsafe.
Yeah, they changed these programs every couple of years, realizing that they're ineffective and unsafe, and new programs start to come up. I mean, the original program, and I kid you not, had told pedophiles when they got out of prison that if they had urges for a child, they were supposed to huff chemicals and pass themselves out. So this was sort of the level of treatment that we were paying for. that these people were willingly going to knock themselves out.
You also write here, as a result of this, and this was in the California Superior Court, cases concerning fraudulent billing and, you know, how the taxpayers are having to cover these bills to private corporations. As a result, Coalinga cost taxpayers $198 million of the state's $1.3 billion hospital budget in 2012.
Yeah, that's just one year. But yes, they're falsifying. I was able to get access to patients' billing statements and documents, and there was medicine and other charges on there that these individuals had never received. And so where that money goes, I have no clue, or where the medicine goes, if it was even purchased, where that goes. So there's this basically black hole of money that I was unable to follow. I think future research definitely needs to verify these claims, especially since taxpayers are going to be on the hook for them once these civil detainees are unable to pay.
We're talking to Nolan Higdon, Professor Nolan Higdon. We're talking about his five-part series at projectcensored.org, Justice for Sale. I'm Mickey Huff. And then it isn't just the Coalinga prison itself. That's obviously a case study that you specifically did. But you cite other areas or other places where these are also problems.
This is a national problem. I don't think any individual has the time to visit all of these facilities. But this was just sort of one little sliver that I randomly chose and found these problems. Who knows what else is going on across the country. But ironically, despite the major problems with Coalinga, other areas are trying to build the same thing. Stockton, California is currently trying to do the exact same thing, build another facility out there. So this system has not really stopped, and I think it goes back to what I said in my original point, is that this tough-on-crime politics really seems to be working. There's not a lot of the voting populace that's sort of standing up for people of color or pedophiles or others, and so this corruption is allowed to continue inside this industry.
So let's go to the final part of your series, Justice for Sale, Nolan Higdon. It's titled Rebellious Action in a Corrupt Time. And how did you wrap up this series? What is going on in the conclusion?
The first four parts of the series I thought were really good at laying out these problems and this corruption. But I did want to falsify the image that no one is doing anything. There are different groups who are doing having different responses to this. And I want to make sure that I highlighted these different methods, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't. But the point was to sort of highlight what people are and are not doing. And I try to look at ways of resistance or things that are changing. So even like Coalinga, which I talked about a moment ago, prisoners are doing sit-down strikes inside the prison when they're being forced to purchase materials from private vendors. But there's also been violent resistance in prisons as well. Both youth prisons and adult prisons have had violent riots against these private prison corporations. In fact, violence is more widespread in private prisons than it is in public prisons. And the reason for that could be the cutting of food, cutting of staff. That's common in the private prisons.
Professor Nolan Higdon, any closing remarks for us today?
No, just thank you for having me on the show and hope to hear more from everyone.
You can be contacted. Give people an email address if they'd like to contact you.
Sure. You can contact me at NolanHigdonProjectCensored@gmail.com. It's NolanHigdonProjectCensored@gmail.com. My contact information is also available at projectcensored.org.
Professor Nolan Higdon, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the series, Justice for Sale. After this brief musical break, we'll be back with former Black Panther Charlotte O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C., and we'll hear highlights from her talk, Empowering Students in Social Justice. Please stay with us.
Never die, no fade away. Keep hop alive, never go astray. Strategize, sacrifice every step of the way. Analyze, sanctify at the end of the day. I brought the G.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. For the remainder of the show today, we're going to hear highlights from a speech by former Black Panther Charlotte O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. Charlotte O'Neill is a 60s Black Panther from Kansas City. Today, she's an artist, poet, and community leader. She runs the United African Alliance Community Center, which offers classes for hundreds of Tanzanian children. Charlotte O'Neill, at the age of 19, escaped from the United States in 1970 with her Black Panther husband, Peter O'Neill. first to Algeria, then to Tanzania, East Africa, where they homesteaded and built a farm and community center in the spirit of the Black Panther Party in the U.S. Here are some highlights from Charlotte O'Neill's recent talk. She gave this as part of Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week.
I would like to welcome you all to our second keynote event of Social Justice Week here at Sonoma State. This is Charlotte O'Neill, a.k.a. Mama C. She comes from Tanzania. She is a former Black Panther with her husband out of Kansas City. And she and her husband co-founded the United African Alliance Community Center in Tanzania. And she is currently the administrator of that. And she's here tonight to speak to you about empowering students in social justice. And please give her a big round of applause.
Thank you. Thank you, Shelby, for that introduction. And in addition to what she says about me, I am a wild woman. I am a panther woman, a warrior woman, a warrior wild for peace. And I will take you by the collar and come up close to you and get all up in your face and make you drool and get wet round the edges for the taste of it. I'm talking about peace. For the thrill of it, peace. For the sweet of it, peace. For the addictionness of it, peace. And I am a wild woman. I am a panther woman, a warrior woman, determined to make you want a piece of this peace that we must spread onto every slice of humanity that we can reach with our sharp weapon of peace. And I'll take you roughly by the wrists and twist you back around and twist and twist and twist and turn your mind to the point of understanding. Mwa faka. Don't get worried. That's a Kiswahili word. And it means understanding. Understanding, overstanding. Who would ever dream that a word so close in sound to a sound of hurt, of rage, an impotent curse, could mean such a gentle, necessary, vital thing? Mwafaka. There was a time I was afraid to say that word. So afraid I might mispronounce the sounds and inadvertently spew out that rage word. You know the one I mean, don't you? That symbol of much hissing negativity, whose sounds used to be used in careful and meaningful and powerful and heartfelt descriptions, now reduced to mere embellishments of radio sound. And I am a warrior woman, a panther woman, a warrior woman wild for peace through empowerment, through pride, through creativity, equality, and love, 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 through love, y'all. Yeah. So being a panther taught me about love. It taught me about community. It taught me about social justice. When we would have our political education classes, you know, and some of the people who joined the party, some of them sometimes couldn't read hardly. But in order to participate in those discussions, they learned how. The Panther Party consisted of all kind of people across the whole strata. You had people from the streets. You had people who were teachers, lawyers, doctors, students like I was. All of us were eager to do something to turn things around. You have to consider that, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, you had the Vietnam War going on. This was coming off the back of the what we call the Civil Rights Movement. You had the police busting us, if you know that term, every day, all across the country, beating us, locking us up, setting us up. And I was gone 20 years, and I'll go back to why. And when I came back for the first time in 1990, in the first speaking engagement that I had in Kansas City, the main subject was the fact that this priest, this African priest, had been brutally beaten by the police. And when I got up there on that mic, I said, y'all, this is deja vu. And that deja vu is still going on strong. It's hard to believe, you know, that all this is still happening. After all that we went through, after all Martin Luther King and all of that era went through, after what our ancestors went through, and what your ancestors went through. We got so much work ahead of us. And when I think, you know, we mentioned COINTELPRO, and y'all promised me you're going to look that up, right? That's the initial, so let's write it again. COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO. And that was started, if my history is right, and Professor, you might want to correct me, by J. Edgar Hoover, right? And it was started, many people think that that was started to bring the Black Panther Party down, but it was going on well before then. It was going on when Martin Luther King was protesting in the streets. But it did its job. And it did cause so much dissension within the Black Panther Party, the Weathermen, the SDS, the Vietnam protest movement, all of that. And you would think that a government would want its people to come up with ways to bring people together, to bring communities together. But that was a threat. And so many young people have on, young people in particular, have on blinders now and refuse to see that, refuse to even investigate. But I know y'all not like that, right? Because if you were, you wouldn't be here. You wouldn't be here to try to gain even a few words or some of the vibe of what I'm speaking to you on, and to gain something from the more than four decades of experience that I have had navigating through this world, navigating and working with people who are very interested in doing what they can to make what we call social justice a reality. I have comrades from the Black Panther Party, comrades from the Native American community who have been locked up for more than four decades for things that they did not do, for things that are a result of COINTELPRO. And when we knew about all of this that was going on, even though we were teenagers, we were determined to do what we could. We'd be out protesting, free Huey, free all political prisoners. And we still got to do that. After all this time, we still got to do that. Comrades are dying in prison. People are disappearing. People are being locked up in detention. And when you say the words political prisoner, it seems like there's always an image of the so-called third world that comes to mind. But you have to consider that America has more people locked up than any other country on the planet. And many of them are political prisoners. Did y'all know that? Does that blow your mind? Does that make you want to do something, anything? Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Who was it? Was it George Jackson who said, who was also a political prisoner? Did he say, if you can't do anything, that even if you can't think of anything to do, at least spit in the wind? So, you're never too young to know about what's going on. You're never too young to try to do something about it. Many young people, they say, well, we don't have these organizations like you all used to have, where it was thousands of people rallying behind this and rallying behind that. But you know what I say? You can do something even without an organization, even if it's two people. You can mentor someone, and you can teach them about this. You can share your knowledge. You can even do something like starting an urban garden. There's so much that you can do as young people and those that aren't that young. Protest songs. Songs of freedom. I was at the Conference of World Affairs last year in Boulder, Colorado. And one of the panels that they wanted me to be on was about protest songs. And I came out with, you know, some of our Panther protest songs off the pick, you know. And then some people came out with the Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan, and all these kind of songs. And as we were talking about them, it really brought home to me how these songs are so important, how something like that is something you can rally around, you know. The poetry. So it doesn't have to be, you know, you're going to change something by picking up a weapon and getting in the street. It doesn't have to be like that. As a matter of fact, it would be very difficult these days because things have changed so much. I can remember when we would organize ourselves, and this, of course, was before the era of internet and even before the era of photocopying machines, and we had to use mimeograph machines. Y'all remember that? Can you still smell that ink? Huh? Yes. I know a lot of you young people, y'all probably haven't heard of a mimeograph machine. Huh? Have you? Yes. You know? And I think, what if we had had the internet the way you all had it? You know, I mean, we did so much of our organizing through phones. Of course, this was before cell phones. We did our protests, you know, by, you know, hand lettering our signs. We couldn't go to a print shop. Couldn't afford it, for one thing. And I don't think they really had it, those facilities for regular people like we were in the community. I often think, man, if we had had the internet. But I'm on the internet now. I'm on Facebook. And it's really something now. Inevitably, I was going to see how you all were going to react. Inevitably, when I say I'm on Facebook, I get smiles and laughter. And I said, why is that? Someone told me, well, many elders don't use Facebook. Yeah? But I think that social media is such an effective way to organize. It's an effective way to put out the announcements of what's going on. It's an effective way to start mentoring groups. All of us have some kind of passion, right? Have you young people discovered your passion yet? So I always say, whatever your passion is, That's what you should share with somebody, and that's what you should build on. Whether your passion is urban gardening, and I think that's a beautiful thing. I mean, people are taking over all these empty lots and transforming them. And this is a way that people can come together, meet your neighbor. Because it's not the way it was when we were coming up, where you knew who your next door neighbor was. Share your knowledge, y'all. That's how we build community. That's how we change society. That's how we make sure that we have justice. Something that I've noticed is that there are a lot of classes now that aren't being taught. And some of those classes are geography. Something as simple as geography. If you're not learning about the rest of the world, you're not going to care about the rest of the world. Let me go back and give y'all a little history. Brother Pete O'Neill, who's been my husband for 46 wonderful, blessed years. 46 years, that blows my mind. Yeah, you know, I feel like coughing too. Because you don't see that much anymore. And I think one of the things that has cemented our relationship is the fact that we both believe that we have to do something about this thing called social justice or social injustice. We have to continue to do something to assist our community no matter where we are on the planet. He was the founder and the chairman of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party. That's why I met him when I was 18 years old. He was my older man because he was 29. So that's how we started, by working together and organizing these breakfast programs in Kansas City where we were feeding like 600 and 700 children a day. Free breakfast. And this was happening all across the country, y'all, in every chapter. Y'all remember that, huh? In every chapter. This was before the United States government had even started these programs like Head Start. And I don't know what some of the other breakfast programs are called to this day, but the Black Panther Party had the pilot project for that. And if that's not ensuring social justice, I don't know what is. Feeding people who otherwise wouldn't have it. We had free medical clinics, y'all. And everybody would organize themselves to volunteer. There was a spirit of volunteerism. We weren't getting paid to do none of this. And a revolutionary doesn't have a pension fund. We don't bop till we drop. So all of the leaders in the Black Panther Party and other progressive organizations were targeted by COINTELPRO, by the FBI, probably by the CIA. And so they were set up with different charges that forced them to go to prison. Like I said, many of them are still in the prison. My husband received a charge of carrying a gun, a 12-gauge old shotgun, across state lines, a gun that he was never found with, a gun that they found another Panther with, a gun that the police confiscated and then had and sold it and had to buy it back so it could be in his trial. And he received 5 years for that. The main witness was a paid FBI informant. The same situation that one of our comrades, Geronimo Gijaga, you might know him as Geronimo Pratt, who was locked up for 27 years for something that the police knew he didn't do. He was in a completely different city. But his main witness was also a paid FBI informant. And it goes on and on and on. This happened to so many people. And once they would have our comrades in prison, they would keep piling up the charges or kill them. So many of our comrades, unfortunately, didn't explore the fact that they could leave the country. There was what I call the Underground Railroad, a modern Underground Railroad of comrades all around the planet who were in place to help those who wanted to escape. And I say escape, I don't say flee. Because when you flee, it's like you're like no plan. When you escape, there's a plan. There are people to aid you. There's a beginning and there's an end. When we escaped, it was in the trunk of a car, and I had claustrophobia, y'all. I had claustrophobia bad. Y'all know what claustrophobia is? But I called on my ancestors. I called on that spirit of the Black Panther Party, and I was able to deal with that. When we left, we ended up in Algeria. Algiers, Algeria, which was the hub of all the liberation movements in the world in those days. That was in 1970. And it was established by Eldridge Cleaver and a lot of our other comrades. We lived and worked there for 2 years, and then we found out about Tanzania. Tanzania was a strongly socialist government in those days. And President Nyerere, who was the first president, had sent out a call to Africans in the diaspora and other progressive people to come and participate in nation building. So there was a large contingent of Africans from the diaspora and many from the Midwest. The reason there were many from the Midwest was because one of his ambassadors had given a talk at Kansas State University and had urged people to come, and they did. They said, y'all need to come here. Socialist government, Ujamaa going on, camaraderie everywhere, and we did. And we went there as political refugees and were accepted as and welcome as political refugees. And a lot of times people don't think that political refugees can come from America and go somewhere. They always think in terms of the third world. But we had several comrades who went into exile. You probably heard of Asada, who went into exile years later in Cuba. We had Settlewell, we had Don Cox, and I'm mentioning them because they have passed away. And it was no secret that they were in Africa. So we're about the only ones left in Africa. I'm not in exile. I couldn't come back for 5 years, but all my charges were dropped, and we never could figure that out. But we said, hey, it's all good. But Brother Pete still can't come back. There's no statute of limitations on that. When we left, he was due to go to two other trials, and both of them had to do with disrupting of religious service because we were demanding that this church, it was all Caucasian, and they were in the middle of the African-American community. We were demanding that they contribute to the community. And it was a big brawl when we went and presented our manifestos and this and that. 200 people were arrested that day. People didn't even have anything to do with it. They let everybody go, but they charged Brother Pete. So he was due to go to trial that Monday. We left that Thursday. And he's been gone ever since. Despite the fact that there have been petitions to have him exonerated. Even there's a congressman, Emanuel Cleaver, has been trying to get this done for years. Books have been written about it. And Brother Pete, who'll be 75 years old this July, he's like, concentrate on getting the word out about political prisoners. He said, I am fine. I am blessed. I am happier than I've ever been in my whole life. You know why he's so happy? Because the work that we were doing as members of the Black Panther Party, all this community service, we're still doing it. We're still doing it in this village called Embassani in Tanzania, in the foothills of Mount Meru, where we have the United African Alliance Community Center. We have daily classes for youth and elders in our community. All of it's free. That's the legacy of the Black Panther Party. All of it is taught by volunteers. That's the legacy of that spirit of volunteerism. And we're raising 21 beautiful, creative, lovely children. 21, y'all. Huh? And we've kept it grassroots. We've had corporations who have come to us and offered to give us a lot of money. But when you read on the dotted line, you see they want to change everything and run everything. So it's harder when you are doing this work and have to come up with all the funds yourself. But you can maintain your integrity like that. At least that's how we look at it, you know. And it's a blessing. And I always say, and I was sharing this just today, that the fact that he's in exile and the fact that we have continued to do all this community work, despite that, is the greatest revenge. And I love that. Yes. I love that.
That was the voice of Charlotte O'Neill. She recently gave a talk for Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week. The talk was titled Empowering Students in Social Justice. We started the program today speaking with Professor Nolan Higdon about his series Justice for Sale at ProjectCensored.org.
We want a smash, crash, mass, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud. This pumping rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear. We ain't scared. This is the vision.
I'd like to thank all of you for joining us today. The Project Censored Show airs on 22 stations around the U.S. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. I'm Mickey Huff. We'll see you next time.
We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters. When the people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of lift your brothers and your sisters. When the people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters. When the people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of lift our brothers and our sisters. When people organize can build the kind of
unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous, so the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for, while taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu,
we got that love, we've lived our brothers and our sisters.